The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got an awesome show for you today. We open up with a little Purim music. Purim is in exactly 2 weeks from today, as a matter of fact. In this half hour, we will be interviewing author Edmund Levine, who has written a book called A Child of Christian Blood, Murder and Conspiracy in Tsarist Russia, The Bayless Blood Libel. I have been wanting to do a show about the Bayless trial for a zillion years, probably since this is our 18th year anniversary this today, as a matter of fact. I think it's probably close to 18 years that I've been wanting to do that. Yes, it's happy birthday to us, by the way. I should have had us play. You got happy birthday in there, Ben? No, Ben doesn't have happy birthday. But it is our birthday today, and we're so glad that you're able to do this. We have a wonderful selection of Jewish music of all kinds. The portion of the week begins with the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, is found in Leviticus 1:1, and we're going to see if we can tie that in with a little bit with the upcoming holiday of Purim. An awesome story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israel destroyed surface-to-surface missiles in a Hezbollah convoy crossing from Syria into Lebanon. The missiles were able to carry very heavy warheads. The strike was the seventh known operation since the Syrian civil war began in 2011 and was an expression of Israel's clear policy regarding that it will not let Syria's war become an opportunity for Hezbollah to improve its anti-Israel arsenal. Hezbollah has threatened reprisal. This week's terrorist news, I kind of have to at this point lump them all together because it's just, that's the way they're happening at this point. One Arab terrorist was killed and two arrested in a raid on an Arab village near Bet El. The Israeli SWAT team was disguised as Arabs to avoid unnecessary casualties. Police arrested three Arab rioters for throwing rocks and firecrackers at police on the Temple Mount. Two police officers were wounded. Alert IDF soldiers foil an attack when they caught two Palestinians carrying six pipe bombs near Carnil. Arabs taking part in a funeral burned down a police post at the Lion's Gate in Jerusalem. Jerusalem police did not arrest anyone. In other news, the Chabad Synagogue in Zaporizhia, Ukraine, located 250 miles southeast of Kiev, was firebombed over the weekend amid the mass protests that toppled President Viktor Yanukovych. No one was hurt, and only minor damage was caused to the building. A new Pew Research Center survey showed that Palestinians dislike the U.S. more than any other country or group, with 76% of respondents saying America is an enemy. In contrast, Israeli said only 1% of Israelis polled dislike the U.S. Israel was removed from the U.S. State Department's white lists, which allows people to enter the U.S. without a visa. Israel was put on the list in 2007 because less than 3% of visa applications were refused. 9.7% of the 125,000 applications were refused in 2013. The IDF, this is a little bit trivial, the IDF Information Security Department issued tough guidelines prohibiting soldiers from using WhatsApp on their smartphones for IDF-related information. Chatter over a WhatsApp group can easily reveal enough intelligent information to prove dangerous if it falls into the wrong hands. The list of the world's 1,867 billionaires was published this week. The richest American Jew is Sheldon Adelson, ranked 8th. The richest Israeli is Ayel Ofer, ranked 206. He only has $3.5 billion, Nebuch. And finally, this is what's into that story of, huh? Inspectors at Ben-Gurion International Airport arrested two people for smuggling in two handbags containing 34 rare parrots. At least they didn't try to hide the parrots like in their pants. like that woman who tried to smuggle, what was it, alligators and snakes or something in her on her clothing into Israel. Authorities believe the parrots were intended for breeding and sale in Israel. Yeah, of course. What else are they going to do with them? Eat them? And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We are online with author Edmund Levin, who has written a book. This is like the book on the subject at this point from what I've seen. A Child of Christian Blood, Murder Conspiracy in Tsarist Russia, The Bayless Blood Libel. How are you today? And welcome to the Jewish Hour, Mr. Levin.
I'm fine, and thanks for having me.
Okay. This is, I don't know if you were listening with my introduction, but the Jewish Hour is celebrating its 18th year this month. And for the last, I would say, 17 and three quarters years, I have wanted to do a show about the Bayless trial and never had like the material, the impetus. And it's very appropriate. This is Chai Tzum Levin. This is our, the number 18 represents life in Judaism. And so here we are. Let's back up before we get into it. What prompted you to do investigative research into this Bayless trial, which has happened an entire century ago, Edmund Levin?
What prompted me is I'm a writer, and I'm always looking for things to write about. And my grandmother, you could say it started with my grandmother. She mentioned it. She grew up in Tsarist Russia at the turn of the last century. In what is now Ukraine, in a shtetl, like probably some of your forebears and others, many other Jews' forebears. And she mentioned the case when I was a kid, and I also later studied Russian history. I knew a bit about it. And then as I delved into it, I started looking around a few years ago and found that really very little had been written about it, even though it was an incredible, I would say, the most sensational trial of its time. I mean, 100 years ago, the trial took place in 1913. Mendel Bayless was one of the most famous people on earth. And I found that there had been a lot of material from the former Soviet archives that was now available shed light on this incredible trial, this man who was put on trial for the ritual murder of a Christian boy in 1913 and was a worldwide sensation.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the history. The farce of the absolute insanity. I remember learning about blood libels in Hebrew school when I was a kid, maybe I think it was fourth grade Hebrew school, which would have made me 12, okay, about hearing about such a thing, just wondering, how could people be so stupid to think that people murder other people because they need their blood to make matzah?
That's a really hard question to answer, and I think historians have debated it. The blood libel goes back to the 12th century. The ritual murder myth goes back to the 12th century in England, and then it kind of developed kind of the core idea that Jews kill Christians who bake matzah. Why people believe it is hard to say. Springs from some kind of hatred, and it really is a very bizarre idea.
Yeah, it definitely the anti-Semitism. I don't think you could have a more anti-Semitic accusation than accusing somebody of killing a kid for their blood.
Yeah, there is some psychological theories that the idea that it's kind of a projection of the Catholic emphasis on the blood of Christ, and it somehow comes from that. and therefore they think, well, you know, the Jews must also find blood to be important. But it really is it's a very convoluted idea, and I think it's hard to say from where it springs.
Yeah, indeed. My just a little personal insight. My Zeta, I was at probably about 6 or 7 Sidurim that I remember. Mm-hmm. And everybody else around the table was drinking red wine or grape juice. My Zeta, my grandfather, drank white wine. Mm-hmm. And it was a sautern that he bought, I think probably cost him like $2 a gallon of stuff. It was absolute. To call it vinegar would be polite. Yeah. And I asked my grandmother, why does he drink this stuff? I was like a 4-year-old kid saying, why is he doing this to himself? And she just said, the red wine gives him heartburn. Okay, and that's the way I left it. I did not find out until 30 years later when I happened to be sitting around the table with my mother and some aunts, and I mentioned that, you know, Zeta used to get heartburn from red wine. And my aunt looking at me saying, what are you talking about? And I said, yeah, Bubby told me that he drank white wine. She said, that's not why he drank white wine. He drank white wine because in the town where he grew up, there was a blood libel, and the rabbis there issued a decree that they're not allowed to drink red wine.
That's really interesting. Very interesting.
They had to drink white wine to show we got nothing to do with blood over here.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, and certainly the idea of ingesting blood is totally antithetical to Jewish doctrine, for sure. So
Tell us about the halacha. Tell us about the Jewish law of blood. Why of eating blood? Why this doesn't make so much sense? Why it's so antithetical?
Well, I think you are a much bigger expert on Jewish law than I am, but obviously, the idea of ingesting blood is totally antithetical. All efforts are made to drain blood from meat and not to ingest any sort of blood.
Yeah, aside from the fact that it's disgusting, it happens to be one of the 365 prohibitions. And anybody who willfully eats blood in Judaism is punished with corporal punishment. I mean, it's a serious offense. We're not into it. Okay, so now, there were 1913. This is
right.
What we refer to as the modern era. We're after the Age of Enlightenment. People are sort of like, we've got communism on the rise. We have socialism on the rise. There's social justice. People are starting to look out for people. Slavery's been abolished. We're becoming humanists. What throwback? Where was the throwback in 1913, in Russia, that promulgated? What was it? In other words, tell us the circumstances around which led up to this blood libel.
The circumstances. I mean, Russia at the time was on the brink of disaster. This was 1913, before war and revolution, and people had a sense that things were going badly, this country had always been anti-Semitic, and the czar at the time, Nicholas II, was an extremely anti-Semitic person. This might seem obvious, but while Russia was a very anti-Semitic place, he was even more anti-Semitic than his ministers. We don't know his exact role, but I think it seems likely that he was very much for this. He really did not like Jews. The long and the short of it is I think that what happened was that in Kiev, a boy was killed. And I always like to remember that in these blood libel cases, there almost always is a victim. Sometimes the victim is imaginary. There actually is no victim. And they find a Jew to be the person supposedly killed the imaginary victim. But in this case, there was a victim, and there usually is. His name is Andrei Yushinsky. And I think it's important to remember that when there's a blood libel, there's usually a murderer who goes free, who was never found because a Jew was accused of the crime. So in this case, a poor boy, poor Christian boy named Andrei Yushinsky was killed. And in Kiev at the time, the local anti-Semites raised the hue and cry that a Jew had killed this boy. And then local officials picked up on it. Then people in Parliament picked up on it. And then the Tsar's ministers picked up on it, I think, mainly believing that it would please him to push a case like this. So I see Tsar Nicholas as kind of a key figure. But yes, Russia was a more or less civilized country in the sense it had a legal system. You know, they had rules of discovery. They had courts. It was looked like a relatively westernized system.
If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Edmund Levin. He's written a book called A Child of Christian Blood. It's about the Mendel Bayliss affairs, we'll call it right now. You had access to the Russian archives, Edmund?
Yeah, well, there Kiev, what is now the Kiev State Archive, put out a lot of documents on microfilm. I went there to the library there, and I got more documents, and they're really filled out the story. And I read Russian, so I could read all the original sources.
That's terrific. Did you find anything that really had any kind of concrete implication against Tsar Nicholas II and his involvement in it?
Well, I won't give myself credit, but there is a document that was found by another scholar where Tsar Nicholas, when he went through documents, he would make a little, he would make a very distinctive mark on the documents. He would to show that he had read it. He put a forward slash with two dots next to it. And there is one document with that, kind of an important document with his mark on it. So it seems like there's scant documentation, but it seems like he was following the case pretty closely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, as far as the book is concerned, the book is as far as I'm concerned, is two thumbs up. I would call it required reading, and your style, your style and presentation, it definitely reminded me of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. The only difference is in Crime and Punishment, we know the guy did it, and it's just a matter of seeing how he winds up getting caught. In this one, since it's a historical overview, we know the guy didn't do it.
Right.
But how do we see that he gets off? He was arrested in 1911. The trial was over in 1914. So he's 3 years sitting in jail. This is a long, arduous process for something which would seem so open and shut. What took so long? Why did the trial drag on so long, Edmund?
The Russians then, and maybe now, are not the most organized people, perhaps is one reason. But he was arrested, Mendelbel. Let me say a little about him. He was a hardworking family man, father of five, worked in a brick factory, which was owned by a Jewish magnate. He was arrested in July of 1911, dragged out of his home in the middle of the night and held for 2.5 years in horrible conditions. One of the reasons it took a long time was that while we think of Russia as a horribly anti-Semitic place then, and it was, the government was pretty hesitant about bringing this case as a blood libel. It took them a while, a couple of drafts of indictments, to really decide, okay, we're going to charge this man with ritual murder. Even the Russians at that time, the Russian officials, were quite hesitant. There was also a lot of protest against it, and one of the hopeful things about the book is there were many good people, many good Christian people, Christian officials who said this case is crazy. And you look in the documents, in the secret documents, and there are people who say this man is innocent. This is not a good idea to go forward with this case. So it took a while to clear away the opposition and move forward with the trial. So these were not all bad people. It's not a tale of pure villainy. There are a lot of good people in the story, which is one of the reasons why I like to write it.
Mm-hmm. Generally, whenever there's some sort of an accusation, looking through the annals of history, when there's an accusation against the Jews, specifically as something like this, like a blood libel, usually the man on the street in wherever that place is usually takes up arms and is usually followed by some sort of a pogrom, which is an attack against Jews, and somehow that didn't happen in Kiev, did it?
No, that did not happen, and it happened. It did not happen, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is the government had a very contradictory impulse. On the one hand, they raised this charge against the Jew, which would inflame the populace. At the same time, they were very concerned. They did not like Russia has a reputation for pogroms. In fact, at this time, the government did all it did in these years to really tamp down anti-Jewish violence. They did not want disorder. That was not because they liked Jews. They did not want disorder. So that was one reason. Another reason is that Bayless, he had a fair amount of support among Christian people, ordinary people. And there's a very, I think, moving scene in the book when he goes back, the whole court goes back to his old neighborhood to survey the crime scene. And he is greeted by people who know him in the street, and they say, "Hello, Mendel." And they doff their caps, and it's a very warm greeting from people who are overwhelmingly Christians. They knew him, and according to some sources, they called him Nash Mendel in Russian. That means our Mendel. So he had good relations with people there.
Indeed. This is, I mean, Around the same time, there was a similar type of case going on in the South in America.
Yeah.
And that, the person was vindicated, and as soon as he walked out, he was lynched by a mob. You remind me of the person's name.
Leo Frank.
Leo Frank, thank you very much.
Yeah, Leo Frank, he was convicted, actually, and he was lynched. He was lynched later. He was taken out of jail. A very, very similar case. It's a strange parallel. He was a pencil factory manager, and although much, much more well-to-do than Mendel Bayliss, and he was convicted and then lynched later. So you know, there's anti-Semitism everywhere. you know, we shouldn't get too much nihilist about Russia. Because in a way, I thought I see Russia as kind of a warning sign. It was a very anti-Semitic place. At the same time, the blood libel came from the West. It did not originate in Russia. It originated in Western Europe, and obviously bad things happened in Western Europe in the subsequent decades. So to me, the Bayliss case was in a way a little bit of a warning sign. Maybe the people, you know, they said, "Oh, terrible Russia! How could these dark things happen there?" And maybe at the time they should have looked at themselves and say, in Western Europe especially, and said, "Hmm. Maybe we should think about what's going on here as well."
Well, America had a very sizable Jewish community at that time. What was and a very prominent, and they were up. They were sort of now becoming upward mobile. I know in reading the history of Detroit, Temple Beth El and Temple Shari Tzedek were huge edifices already at that point,
yeah,
with large congregations, and there was money behind it. Where was the American Jew for the Mendel Bayliss trials, Edmund Levin?
Well, I found that was a very interesting and illuminating part of the story to me. That was really unexpectedly illuminating. The reaction of the American Jewish leadership was very hesitant. And it's an interesting theme in Jewish history, especially in modern Jewish history, as Jews sort of rose up, became more prominent, wealthier. What happens when a Jew is in trouble? What do you do? Do you speak up? Will that make this make more trouble? Or do you say something? And indeed, the American Jewish leadership, like the American Jewish Committee, held meetings. What do we do? Do we say something? The American Jewish Committee eventually decided to do basically nothing. They got some Christian clergymen to sign a petition. But there were, however, toward the end of the trial, there were massive demonstrations in many places in the United States in support of Bayliss. Which really were not organized so much by the Jewish leadership. There was in Chicago, there was a tremendous demonstration headlined by Booker T. Washington and Jane Addams, thousands of people in the Chicago Loop. That was really, totally forgotten episode. Really, I thought it was just an amazing scene, people of all faiths, ethnicities, getting together in support of Bayliss.
Mm-hmm. Was that organized by the Jewish community, or that was just...
That was organized by not... I don't think Jews had much to do with that. I mean, I think it was Jane Addams got, you know, and other people. But the American Jewish Committee purposely kind of stayed back and didn't do much. Mm-hmm. Again, and you can kind of sympathize with them. You wonder, it was legitimate concern whether speaking up would hurt Bayliss or help him. They had the same kind of quandary with the Leo Frank case in the South. You know, if we say something, is it going to, will the jury think, well, the Jews are manipulating all this, you know? So you can understand their quandary.
Was that the reason, or maybe there was also the idea of, well, we're guests in this country, don't make waves, don't draw attention to ourselves?
I that's an interesting point. I think by that time, I think certainly don't make waves, for sure. They feel like guests. I'm not so sure. I think it was a fairly legitimate concern, but I think you can say that maybe they should have done more. But you do have a point there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're just tuning in again, our guest is Edmund Levin, who's written a book called A Child of Christian Blood: Murder and Conspiracy in Tsarist Russia, The Bayliss Blood Libel. Was there any kind of aftermath from the Bayliss trial? Did the Russians sort of like become wonderful people afterwards because of this? Is anti-Semitism decreased because they realized, oh boy, we made fools of ourselves? What was the aftermath of the Bayless trial?
The aftermath, the positive aftermath was, there were no pogroms. There was really no anti-Jewish violence. There was hope among liberal Russians, progressives, that, the regime will now realize that, the liberal Russians were not just worried about this because it was a Jew. They saw it as a symptom of a regime that was just totally off the rails in every sense, not just in terms of anti-Semitism, but in terms of a government that could not manage the country, manage its transition to being a modern state. And they figured, maybe now people will realize that this government has to change, the autocracy will reform itself, but that did not happen. Nothing terribly bad happened in the aftermath, but not much good happened in the aftermath, too, for the country.
Mm-hmm. A minute detail in the book, which sort of, as soon as I saw it, caught my eye because of my background. There was somebody by the name of Schneerson involved with all of this.
Yes.
Tell us about this. And the reason why I'm asking, of course, is because I am a follower of the Blavatsky Rebbe, whose name is Schneerson.
So. There's a character in the book. His name was Feivel Schneerson, or as in Russian they say, Schneerson. It's unclear if he was related to the famous Schneersons of Chabad, but the prosecution saw a nefarious link, and for the prosecution, the Hasidim were really the villains. So they pointed at this fellow Schneerson, this hay and straw dealer who knew Bayless, as saying, you see. There's a connection here to the Hasidim, and of course we know those are the really bad guys. Those are the real fanatics. But that, of course, is also a canard. But he was just a simple, rather curt hay and straw dealer who may not have had much to do with anything to do with religion.
Mm-hmm. He just happened to have the last,
although he may have. I couldn't track that down. I'm not sure. He may have been related, very possibly. But
yeah.
He's a clean-shaven young man.
Yeah, it didn't sound like he was too much of involved with, like, this as a scion of the
Rebbe. He was not a scion of the family.
Yeah, okay. Aside from just wanting just to sell the book, what do you hope is going to be the outcome of your book? What would you like to see your book become?
What would I like to see it become? That's a hard question. I hope it's the definitive, at least so far, and somebody may write about the book someday, history of a case that I think is really important. It's a really important, neglected piece of history, piece of the history of anti-Semitism. Because the case has reverberated, the Nazis didn't use the blood libel too much, but the Bayless case did feature in big issues of Der Stürmer in the 30s, in the Nazi era, a book about the blood libel featuring the Bayless case was distributed to a division of the Einsatzgruppen in World War II. The case is important, so I hope that I've kind of rescued a little bit of history that had been unjustly forgotten.
Mm-hmm. One thing that seemed very disheartening to me, I knew that Mendel Bayless is buried in New York City. I'm not sure if it's in the Bronx or in northern Manhattan, somewhere.
I believe in Queens, but yeah.
Queens. Somewhere where I never went,
yeah.
And which is in itself a thing. Because here is this person, you said it was in 1914, may have been the most famous person in the world. Yet, he passed away pretty much in obscurity. How did that happen?
Yeah, the case was forgotten. He had a pretty big funeral. People did remember him by the end of his death. But he was acquitted of the crime and left Russia, moved to Israel, then to America, but had a hard time making a living and ended up with not being nearly as well known as he was in 1913-14. It's hard to say why the case has been forgotten. It was such a hugely important case at the time. World War I intervened. Then you had World War II and the Holocaust, and that may have affected, kind of recalibrated the way we think of things. You know, we think only of huge genocidal events as being important, perhaps. But I think this was an important case because, you know, as I said, we think of, when we think of Jewish history, we think of massive tragedies, the Holocaust. But I think this case, you're talking about what I hope people would take from the book, and I realize I neglected to make a point. You know, there's not just Nazi evil, there's also smaller sorts of evil, more common sorts of evil that are important. And this was evil on a smaller scale committed by people who were not devils, but more ordinary people who persecuted this poor man. And this is the kind of, you know, not Stalinist evil, not Nazi evil, but human evil that we think we should be aware of and guard against.
Okay, that's going to do it for us. We're out of time for this segment. Our guest has been Edmund Levin. The book, A Child of Christian Blood, Murder and Conspiracy in Tsarist Russia, The Bayless Blood Libel, published by Schocken Books, a division of Random House, available wherever fine books are sold. And thank you so much, Edmund, and wish you continued success.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. We have, for your listening pleasure, now this is the musical part of our show, we have Gad Elbaz, a big Israeli singing star, and this is a piece called Hashem Melech, God is King.
Okay.
assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mycosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mycosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Mendel Bayless trial happened in Kiev. We know what's been going on lately in Kiev. For your music listening pleasure, we have now for you the Kiev Klezmer Band playing a klezmer melody.
Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Hey, Joel Fidman here. We've got time for one more. This is a request. Somebody by the name who identified himself as Yaakov from Oak Park wanted to hear Benny Friedman doing Ad Olam, How Much Longer, Forever and Ever, I guess. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Hey, Herschel Fenton here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week, we begin the portion of Vayikra. It can be found at the beginning of the book of Leviticus, 1:1 and following. It talks about what to do in the sanctuary and in the temple, which were to be was later built in Jerusalem. Animal sacrifices. We have the burnt offering, the flour offering known as the mincha, some guilt offering thrown in and over there. Most of the book of Leviticus contains mitzvahs which we can't do currently, like offer sacrifices. If somebody wants to offer a sacrifice now, even a sacrifice to God, sorry, can't do it. Builds an altar to the specifications. Sorry, can't do it. The point being, that God was really never into barbecue to begin with. I say this all the time. It wasn't the animal. Here we have the scenario where a person did something wrong. And they're thinking to themselves, you know, all I got to do is sacrifice an animal and it's all gone. Terrific. Cost effective. There is nothing more disgusting than such a person who says, I will sin and repent later. I know I'm doing something wrong now. Generally, people, when they do something wrong, they find all kinds of really good excuses as to why it's not something wrong. And then afterwards say, oh, it was something wrong. But here you have this person who's going to say, I know this is wrong. And you know what? I'll clean up the mess afterwards. This is a really serious individual. So God's not into the barbecue. God's into the person's heart, you might say. There's this dedication. The beginning of the verse, it's the beginning of the portion, it says, when a man will offer from among you a sacrifice, which should have said when a person from among you will offer up a sacrifice, not when a person's going to offer up a sacrifice of himself. The sacrifice is us. Because in Judaism, it's not sacrifice. The word carbon, which is translated sacrifice, means to come close. What the Almighty wants from us is to come close. The portion of Vayikra is always read sometime in proximity to Purim. This year it's read 2 weeks before Purim. In previous years, it would be 2 weeks after Purim. But we're still in that Purim mode, you might say. What's the deal with Purim? What really was the big deal is that the Jews rededicated themselves to the Almighty. The scenario goes that at Sinai, the Jews accepted the Torah, yes. But the Medrash writes that the Almighty picked up Sinai, held it over their heads like a barrel, and said, I'm giving you a choice. Either accept the Torah, and this mountain will be like a wedding canopy, or if you refuse to accept the Torah, I'm going to drop this mountain on your heads, and this mountain will be your burial site. So which is it going to be? They all unanimously said, we're going wedding canopy. But what does that say about how the Jews approached Judaism at that point? Out of a sense of compulsion, they were coerced. They felt forced. And indeed, the philosophy, even though Jews were keeping the vast majority of mitzvahs, even someone who we would refer to as a non-religious Jew, kept the mitzvahs for the most part, they didn't want to do it. It wasn't until Purim, when they were faced with annihilation on a single day, the worst decree ever against the Jews, and they stood up and rededicated themselves to God. Then they said, I want to do Judaism because I want to do it. People ask me, what do I do for a living? I tell them, I show people, not I teach people, I show people how Judaism is interesting, exciting, and fun. That's what it's all about. We have to take a quick commercial break. Don't go away. We got the story coming up. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard from the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way? Go to my website, rabbifinman.com, www.rabbifinman.com. Right there on the homepage is a contact link. Send me a letter. I'll send you a letter. We'll be best buddies forever and ever. What else is on rabbifinman.com? We have archived editions of the show. Did you happen to miss Susan Zaccotti last week and talking about the Catholic Church and the Holocaust? It's still there, and we'll be there for a month, as were the previous month's shows, all there. You'll also find the U-Parsha, the Hasidic U-Story, the E-Parsha, which are words of inspiration presented in a hopefully entertaining and educational way by yours truly and other media other than this one. They'll find it right there. And you'll find the very important donations page. It's the first week of March. We today paid for January. They're very patient here at WLQV. But I don't like doing that. It's never happened before that I was actually 2 months behind. We are sponsored, supported a little bit, but primarily we're listener supported, like people just like you. So go to rabbifinman.com, go to the donations page, click on whichever amount you like to give. It's all very safe, secure. It's all through PayPal. Don't like any of the numbers there? There are lots of numbers out there in the universe. There's a little other number over there. You can put in your own number. No number too small, no number too big. Don't like doing internet, credit card stuff? I understand. Send your donation to, of any amount, to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. 40 years ago, a person by the name of Beryl Zlotowicz passed away in Jerusalem. Now, you might wonder why I am mentioning this. This Beryl Zlotowicz was a beggar in Jerusalem, a very interesting beggar, in that he would beg for cigarettes. Never begged for money. He would beg for cigarettes. And people, some people watching him figured that he could beg 100 cigarettes in a day. And no one ever really figured it out. One day he stopped begging and he suddenly was with this very happy person. And no one asked and bothered, what is it? So what was his story? He was a very wealthy business magnate, had a huge fabric factory, I believe in Minsk, which is located near Kiev. And he gave a lot of charity. In fact, he gave charity hundreds of thousands of rubles for the building of a sanctuary for old men in Jerusalem. This is one of his pet projects. He was a horrible boss. He had rules. If you came 10 minutes late, you were docked half a day pay. Terrible. He fired people left and right. If you didn't make the quota, you're out, because he was the one who was making the money. He needed it. Time was money. And if you weren't willing to put up, listen, there are other poor people I can support. And he supported. He paid a good wage. There was no problem with that. 1917 came in. The Bolsheviks came in. They took away everything that he had. He managed to get out of Russia with his life only. Went to Poland and went to Israel right away. And settled in Jerusalem and found a place in that very institution that he helped support for so many decades. And he tells a story that he realized in looking at his situation, that why was he in the situation that he was in, that he was now a refugee? It was because he was such a terrible boss. And it once happened that someone came to him right before the revolution and said to him, his wife is sick and please don't dock his pay. So he said to him, what concern if it is of mine that your wife is sick? And he docked a guy a half a day pay. So he decided that he was going to become a beggar, but he didn't want to beg for money. His needs were taken care of by this institution. So he begged cigarettes. What he did with them, I have no idea. I think it's before the Surgeon General. One day, person, he came to me, he said, please, could I have a cigarette? So the man said to him, what concern of it is of mine that you need a cigarette? So he understood right there. He felt so humiliated, so embarrassed. Did he understand? He understood finally what he had done to another person. And he was able to do a full repentance and return to the Almighty with a pure soul. That's going to do it for the show. We're glad you had a chance to tune in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you again next week. Take care. Hi, the Kayom, Nairo Moroi Mikadosh.